And we return. It is today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. And my apologies to those callers. We couldn't get on the air in our previous segment. And Bonnie, what?
And the emailers.
And the emailer
also. Sorry.
Bonnie, Linda was listening to our segments and found out that we were both under the weather. So she came in. First thing she did was break out the Purell.
Armed with Purell.
Well, perhaps we can look ahead, say, 20 years or so at our food future. Will we be eating conventionally or perhaps more scientifically? Joining me now is chef, author, and syndicated columnist Linda Gastenheimer. So where are you going with this today, Linda?
Well, I want to welcome you to the food frontier.
And we've got at least 4 feet between us, so you don't have anything to worry about.
Right.
Well, I hope that's enough. Well, what's in store? Are we going to have test tube meat? Maybe lemon, basil, cherry, tomatoes, or blue bananas? Or, here's one, stem cell hamburgers?
Mm.
Does this sound interesting, delicious, or what? So is this food in our future? Our guest has some thoughts on this. He's Josh Schoenwald, and his book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food. Let's welcome Josh. Hello, Josh.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you here. Well, I don't know if it's great. We'll have to hear what he's going to make us eat.
I don't know about the stem cell
hamburgers. Well, and also, we'd love to hear from you, our listeners. Do you have any thoughts on food lab in our future? Give us a call. That's 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. And we have email.
That's radio at WLRN.org.
Okay. Also with us, our favorite wine columnist, Fred Tasker. And he's joining us by Skype. You can read Fred's wine column in today's Miami Herald. Is there a future in wine, Fred?
So now you mean I've got to come up with a wine match for stem cell hamburgers?
We want stem cell wine?
That could be a toughie.
All right.
But we'll try.
I know you can handle it. Okay, Josh Schoenwald, your search for the next big thing in food, you talk about Frankenfood. So what is that?
Well, Frankenfood is the term that has been used to describe genetically engineered foods, taking genes from unrelated species and pairing them, and that for the past 15 years has been described as Frankenfood.
As in Frankenstein.
As in Frankenstein. If you take a gene from a Arctic flounder and insert it into a tomato, that's the notion of Frankenfood, which has, terrified many consumers.
Right, that's what we're called GMOs, genetically modified food. So what happens if you take this fish and you put it in a tomato and you're allergic to fish? And you eat the tomato. I mean, what happens?
Well, one of the things that scientists have, intuitively, when people hear about the idea of mixing, unrelated species, they do have these Frankenfood notions. But one person or one scientist made the comparison. If you take a carburetor from a Ferrari and you put it into a Chevy, it doesn't make that Chevy a Ferrari. Taking a single gene hasn't, in the cases that have been in the marketplace so far, shown any evidence of having an adverse health effect. And again, this is a hotly disputed subject, but when you look to the scientific consensus, it's as overwhelming as the science that suggests that, climate change is happening.
Based on real scientific research and into the possible side effects of these things, or are we just assuming they're okay?
No, this is based to, the hundreds of scientific papers by the peer-reviewed science community that have shown that, contrary to a lot of, initial fears about, what's happening and, this sense that it is creepy, I mean, the products that have been out there haven't shown any evidence of having any health effects.
So you have, Josh, you have a different attitude toward we won't call them frankenfoods, we'll call them genetically modified foods. What's your take on it? How is this going to help us?
Well, you know, initially I started this book, and again, I wanted to point out, I didn't mention this, but the story actually, this whole book actually grew out of a Miami New Times article. I was a reporter there in 2005, and I became very interested in how new foods happen after learning about a fish that I think actually Linda's book on the cuisines of or the foods of the Keys mentions, cobia. Cobia has been, you know, described by aquaculturists as the next great fish, and
you know, Josh, I have to say that when I read your book and I saw cobia, and I said, "Well, what's the deal about cobia? We have it here.
Yeah, we've had that
in Florida. It's not necessarily a big commercially grown fish, but we have it. But what you're saying is that this is the next salmon."
Well, this is trace this back to I'm a young reporter, 2006, in Miami, and I meet a aquaculture scientist at the University of Miami named Daniel Benetti, out on Virginia Key, and, you know, I had never heard of cobia, having grown up in Wisconsin. And he tells me that this fish that I'd never heard of is going to be as popular, as commonplace as salmon within 5 years. And he says this is not 99% certain that this is going to happen. This is 99.99%. Now, as you Floridians know, particularly folks in the Keys and sports fishermen, you know, cobia is not a new fish. You know, it's been served down there for years. But as an aquaculture species, as an industrial fish, it has a lot of qualities that lend itself to farming. You know, it grows incredibly fast, 6 times as fast as salmon. It adapts well to a cage. You know, some fish, like mahi-mahi, are sort of like tigers, and they respond very adversely to captivity. Not the case with cobia. You know, it had been described as almost pet-like in the way that it adapted. So, long story short is, you know, many aquaculturists back that cobia was going to, you know, be the next big fish, sort of
okay. So let me ask you then, we'll go from fish to meat, and what's this thing with this test tube hamburger?
Well, the test tube hamburger, you know, again, my search was not initially focused on technology. You know, I wanted to see the myriad ways that food could change, whether it's the discovery of an heirloom variety of radicchio, whether it's, you know, finding a new, you know, obscure ethnic cuisine. But in the case when I started looking at the whole question of the future of meat, and, you know, this is perhaps my naivete, but I quickly discovered that when you're exploring the future of meat question, you're crossing paths very much with the future of Earth question. The tremendous weight that animal livestock farming has on the Earth, you know, just the amount of land and water used. Some estimates say, you know, 20% of the greenhouse gas emissions are from the animal livestock industry. So when I started exploring the question of what meat we might be eating, you know, I wanted to look for a sustainable source of animal protein. You know, some people say that kangaroos are actually a sustainable meat. There's a lot of people who are looking at rabbits. Now, ultimately, though, I did take a look at this lab in the Netherlands, which is focusing on the idea of taking a stem cell from cows, pigs, and chickens, and using that to grow meat. And this is an idea that has been around since actually Winston Churchill.
But let me ask you, has anybody tasted this? Has it actually happened? Are they growing meat in a test tube?
Well, I won't blow the narrative suspense of the book, but in fact, you know, at one point when I set out to go to Holland, I was very excited about having a stem cell chicken nugget. That didn't happen, but there is plans that one of the researchers in the Netherlands is going to debut a stem cell-derived hamburger sometime this fall.
So we could get meat with no birth, no eating, and no elimination.
Exactly. I mean, you know, the idea is very appealing to, you know, people for the ethical treatment of animals is one of the earliest and enthusiastic supporters of the idea. The idea
so the idea is that you take the stem cell and just multiply it into a quarter pounder with
cheese? Well, that's one part of the process. Yeah, that is well, basically, you know, it's a several steps to the process. One is, you know, getting a stem cell, growing it in a medium. Then once you get a sufficient amount, the other obvious challenge is texture, you know, getting the mouthfeel of a cow, chicken, and that is a huge engineering challenge.
How about flavor?
Flavor is also, you know, a huge part of, you know, creating the correct broth of fats and proteins.
Thank you. Before we go to break, let's take one call that's come in, and that's from Glenda in Big Pine Key. And go ahead, Glenda, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I, for one, am very worried about genetically modified and irradiated food. Once they genetically modify it by adding a different cell from something else to it, our bodies may not necessarily assimilate it in the same way. And the fact that they don't have to label these things, you know, that everybody's against labeling it, look at all these new cancers and all this stuff that we have and these new diseases. Cancer is almost like the polio used to be with the bad water. You know, we have a lot of, in fact, they do even more to the plants by genetically modifying the seeds. So the fruit or the plant grows, but you can't use those seeds to grow your own. What kind of study has been done as far as what this food is doing to our bodies?
Okay, Glenda, that's a great question. We're going to take a break. We'll have to answer it on the other side of our break. Thank you for your call. So my guest is Josh Schoenwald. We're talking about the future of food. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Josh Schoenwald. His book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food. And he's been giving us a peek at what types of food are in our future. Just before the break, Glenda was asking about how genetically modified foods were going to affect us. We only have time for a quick, short answer to that. Do you have one, Josh?
Well, first of all, I'd urge the caller to take a look at The Taste of Tomorrow. I began with much of, you know, her suspicions and wariness about genetically engineered foods.
Well, have there been any studies about this at all, or
there
is that still unknown?
There have been hundreds of studies.
Yes.
About testing.
So, did they sway you? Did they sway you?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, finally, you know, you
which way did they sway you?
They swayed me to come to the belief that there are good things that genetic engineering can do, and there are bad things, and that people should not be categorically opposed to GMOs.
There are
crops like vitamin A enhanced golden rice that could do a lot of good for the world. There are crops like herbicide tolerant Roundup Ready corn, which add more chemicals to the world. But as a blanket statement, you know, there's no evidence that genetically engineering as a process is any different than conventional breeding.
Okay.
In terms of human health risk.
Right. And so I think that the answer to one of her questions was, we don't know. We don't know what we're eating because it doesn't have to be on the labels. We don't know about that. But let's go to dinner in minutes so we can eat some real food at the moment. And in your book, Josh, you mentioned that some of the future's new ethnic style foods, maybe Indian food, will become the next Chinese food. And so I have an ethnic flavored Indian dinner in minutes. It's curry kissed chicken with carrots and rice.
Mm.
So, and these guys have got it in front of them, and I'm sorry, Josh, you're
and
not here to
hot
eat it
too.
With us.
I don't get to have, can you teleport a sample here?
Well, maybe that's in the future of food. Who knows?
Well, edible paper. One chef is working on edible paper here in Chicago.
Okay. Well, there's a dusting of curry curry powder flavors this chicken. And also, there's no slicing and dicing for this meal. And it's great for this busy time of year. I use ready-to-eat shredded carrots, and I add them to the cooked rice once it's cooked, so the carrots are warm through, but they're still nice and crisp. And here's a hint about curry powder. It's a blend of 15 different herbs, spices, and seeds, so it loses its flavor quickly. So if you've had some curry powder on your shelf for, let's say, 6 months or more, it's a good time for a new one.
I have some from about 1995, I think.
Yeah, probably. So I'm glad that you even thought to have it, Joe. That's great. Anyway, to make this dish, you just I take chicken tenders because they cook really quickly and they're nice and juicy. I toss it in the curry powder and I saute it for about 2 or 3 minutes on a side. And then I take those out of the skillet, put a little apricot jam and a little cream, and then I spoon that over the chicken. So how do you like that?
Very good.
Okay. And then you just cook the rice according to package instructions, add the shredded carrots, a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. By the way, I wanted to say, even with the cream, all of my Dinner Minutes recipes fit the government guidelines for nutrition. And so that complete recipe and a photo, it's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer. All right. So, Joe, you finished your lunch already?
Yes, indeed. I'm going back for more, too.
Uh-huh. Well, there isn't any more. So, Fred, sorry, you're not eating with us as well. What are we drinking?
Well, if there isn't any more, I guess I can't. Well, actually, the future of wine is pretty bright, and we're going to be seeing a lot of new varieties of grapes that are created through hybridization. It's not quite at the genetic level and that sort of thing. And the reason is that most of the wines that we drink today, the Chardonnays, the Merlots, and all that, come from a single 5,000-year-old species called Vitis vinifera. And because it's a single species, it is vulnerable to being decimated worldwide by a single pathogen. In fact, as recently as the 1990s, most of the vines in California had to be replanted after they were killed by a root louse called Phylloxera. So for the past 150 years or more, growers have been responding to that by creating hybrid grapes, such as things you probably never heard of, Baco Noir, Maréchal Foch, Sauval Blanc, and that sort of thing. And they're a little bit of an acquired taste to some people, but so far anyway, but they're quite popular in the northern U.S. states like New York and Minnesota and Michigan because they can withstand the 15 degree below zero winters that some of the other grapes can't. And, for example, Cornell University in New York has just released two new hybrid grapes that are actually so new they don't even have names yet, only numbers. And if you stick around in the future, these may be your favorite wines with those stem cell burgers. Hard to say.
Perfect.
Second, over the coming century, and something else that will happen in wine is that China will compete with Bordeaux and California in the world wine market. It already makes more wine every year than Australia, and there's no reason they couldn't make good wine there because China lies well within the same geographical area from north latitude 32 to 52 where wine is grown in Europe and America. Now, so far, most Chinese wines aren't very popular in the West. They tend to be a kind of tannic and not as ripe and fruity as Western wines, simply because that's the way the Chinese like them. But that taste could change, and that could catch on in other parts of the world, or they could change the way they make the wines. Already today, in the United States, right there in Miami, you can taste a Chinese wine called Great Wall Cabernet Sauvignon. And I've tried it. It actually goes pretty well with Kung Pao beef.
Oh, there you go.
Now, do you have time for another one, or shall I shut up?
Fred, go ahead. We have about a minute.
Okay, real quick. Finally, online wine sales will skyrocket. America today has more than 6,000 wineries, but because of industry consolidation, a small handful of them sell almost all of the wine. And this leaves the rest of the wineries, including hundreds of small family wineries that make superb wines, competing without all of the national distribution channels the big boys have. So the answer is sell your wine online. It may be the only thing that preserves wine in the variety in the wine that you drink.
Are the shipping costs prohibitive, though?
It... You, very cheap wines are not practical to ship, but if you get a wine that's more than $20 a bottle, they give you discounts on it, and it is practical. Now, you can't do that in every state, but in Florida, you're allowed to receive wine from wineries.
Fred, we're almost out of time, and I was going to ask Josh if he had any interest in the wine of the future, if he'd done any research, but we're out of time, so we'll just have to read his wonderful book and know all about it. Josh Schoenwald. Schoenwald, is that how I say it, Josh?
Yeah, it is Josh Schoenwald. And I just wanted to add one final thing, Linda.
Yes, go ahead.
You know, I know that genetic engineering is kind of like the abortion issue of the food world, and just that people have very strongly held views. It's just a small part of the book. You know, it's broadly a search for how food changes.
It is, and you talk about the salads and how our salads have changed and all, and it's really very, very interesting reading. His book is The Taste of Tomorrow, Dispatches from the Future of Food, and it is great reading. Bonnie and Joseph and Fred, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, next week is our annual Kitchen Gadget Gift Program, one of my favorite. Lots of fun ideas. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.